Okay. Just to say that next week we'll be moving on to conscience, evil, and forgiveness. What I will have to say will not be wildly different from the piece I've written on that, or the version that I want to make you new to say. But what I do want to forewarn you about is that on my reading of the phenomenology has three distinct endings. So it has the end of the chapter on spirit, the end of the chapter on religion, and absolute knowing. And really, it's the end of the chapter on spirit that is the true ending of the book. So you really want to look at that discussion of evil and forgiveness, because what will happen in the other two endings is religion will bring us back to showing that spirit is really what's going on, and absolute knowing will say, oh, well, those two endings you've already seen, they're the same thing. That's all that happens. That's why it's so short, right? Absolute knowing. You get there, you think it's all going to wrap up in, like, what, 11 pages or something? It's absurd. I'll have a few things to say about it. But that means that what we've been doing all year really gets tied together originally in the end of the chapter on the spirit. So you have to think about the book, again, as ending three times, three endings, where the point of the final ending is to reveal the authority of the previous endings. That may just confuse you, but it's all the help I can give you for now. Okay, let me recapitulate with a slight modification where we went last week. I was arguing that enlightenment necessarily involves the notion of revolution, and that absolute freedom operates a double movement. Namely, it first atomizes society, and it must atomize society, that is, making each individual into a separate individual, because freedom must be my freedom or a freedom. So that the requirement of atomization is really the requirement that each individual be free and self-determining, where being free is being a as we will see in Kant, a kind of moral authority. So freedom must be actual, concrete, and therefore particular. Absolute freedom also and simultaneously universalizes. Freedom is absolute if and only if the entire form of life that is projected by freedom is indeed grounded in and determined by nothing but freedom itself. So freedom has to be both this freedom and has to be universal at the same time. Because the claim for absolute freedom necessarily universalizes, then finally it will be that moment of universality that dominates. And the way it dominates is by reducing all particularity to that universality. That is, it has to say of any particular, you must be free. So it has to legislate itself for each and every particular. It is this radicalism that therefore provides the beginning of a critique of all forms of representation. Obviously, because representation just is mediation. So freedom debars representational relationships to the world. It's that denial of representation that makes the general will so vicious. The general will becomes simply a universal purpose, or in Hegel's lexicon, law replaces language, where the assumption is law has about it just that absoluteness of subsumption, while language is mediatory and has capacities for particularity. So the claim of the French Revolution is ultimately that every individual must be free, but in this demand, the way it is posed, there cannot be anything that is you in your particularity which remains. That since you are being reduced to your freedom, there's no way of acknowledging you in your individuality. So the very act that's supposed to be a unique representation of particularity, in fact, denies. Hence the idea of revolution, is the necessary idea of the purity of the revolution. Hegel's thought then is that fanaticism wills only what is abstract. So even though the revolutionaries thought they were willing something concrete, you might think of this as a kind of version of sense certainty in practice. When they say this, they are still willing only the universal, only absolute freedom. Hence, the particular disappears, just as it did in sense certainty. Only now, when the particular disappears, it really disappears. That's the terror. And that's still the price to be paid for refusing the mediation of universality and particularity, of finding a relationship between them. When universal and particular are held apart, reduced to extremes, reason is terroristic, which is why finally Hegel thinks that we have to read back into Kant the terrorism of the revolution. That it reacts back when we see that gap between universality and particularity, which in Kant is metaphysical. The duality between phenomena and noumena. Then we are already in the sphere of terrorism. So logically here, the question is not that of universality per se, but the presumption of a universality that is indifferent to particularity, that cares, if you wish, only for itself. For Hegel, and indeed for Adorno, this indifference is the most virulent form of moral opacity. That is, its indifference is Hegel's own notion of moral sin. And indifference and coldness is also the word he uses. So remember in paragraph 390 at the end, he says, "It is thus the coldest and the meanest of all deaths." And at the end of the very next paragraph, if we didn't get it the first time, he's going to let us know a second time. Being suspected, remember this is the epistemology of suspicion, being suspected therefore takes the place or has the significance and effect of being guilty. And the external reaction against this reality that rests on the simple inwardness of intention consists in the cold matter-of-fact annihilation of this existent self, from which nothing else can be taken away except for its death's mere being. It is not an accident, I think, that when Adorno comes to give an account of what's called the epistemology of Auschwitz, he claims that moral reason, Kantian moral reason, has its own mood, its own Stimmung. And that mood is coldness. And it's the reason, and it's the coldness that leads Adorno, and not just Adorno, to associate Kant with the Marquis de Sade. And I'm claiming that it's the coldness of moral reason. And is the real, I mean, there's a formal one, the Saab, but it's the coldness that they really share as a conception of reason. Indifference. So the recently, I can't remember the name of the author there. It makes absolute sense to me. There's a new book out called Tohu War. And the thesis of the book is that the notion of Tohu War began with the French Revolution. And it began with the French Revolution. Why? Because only with the French Revolution did the idea of universal human dignity arise. When? Why should the idea of total war only emerge with the moment of universal human dignity? Well, because now that we know that all human beings are necessarily dignified, then we have an obligation to make sure that they're free. And the account of total war as, let's call it now, morally driven by ideals, begins with the announcement of the humanism of the French Revolution. So I take the thesis of the Civil War.
It was reviewed about, what, 3 weeks ago in the New York Times, something like that?
It's very recent. Just came out. And it's called Total War. And I take it this is just a perfectly Hegelian thesis. The account of total war as grounded in what's called Kantian moral reason. What else would come of that? So for Hegel, I can see you chagrined at this thought. We will work through it. But, I mean, the obvious thought here is all of Hegel, from the get-go, from the very first week of class when we did The Spirit of Christianity, has been a critique of moralism, right? That the idea of having a self-sufficient moral ideality, which you remember is the image of Abraham, who has to renounce the earth for the sake of the one God. And we said right then that what happens when you, and Hegel's word was renounce love for the sake of your love of the one God, is what you end up doing is sacrificing your kid. Well, Abraham says sacrifice Isaac. Then the French revolutionaries seem like minor. But this is why revolutions, this notion of ideality, right, is death-bearing. That's the claim, that a certain notion of ideality is necessarily death-bearing precisely because of its abstractness and indifference to particularity. And that's there from the get-go in the notion of pure insight, in the very notion of enlightenment reason, in the very idea of reason as self-sufficient and self-determining. So for Hegel, this is the will and the manifestation of the willing of metaphysical presence. This is what's wrong with the notion of presentification, of trying to make something absolutely present here and now. Right? That you can only have it by killing it. The desire for presence is the work of terror. That's the Hegelian critique of presence. The identification of apperceptive self-awareness, the I think, with moral goodness. I self-perceive myself and perceive myself as a legislative will is simply the thought that nothing is good unless I take it as good. That's the I think, the moral I think. Nothing is good unless I take it as good. And this apperceptive self-awareness, this capacity that we each have to make everything relative to our freedom, that claim turns out to be the claim of pure negation, of the negative itself, of freedom willing only itself. and nothing is going to, as it were, match its claim to be self-determining.
That's the lesson we already again learned in the chapter on skepticism.
Right? That skepticism is that demonstration of the purity of the will. So we get here the series of identifications that the I think is the requirement of freedom. Freedom requires the thought of the negative, and the thought of the negative is the thought of death. So here, uniquely, I think, in the phenomenology, the negative as negative appears. This is the appearance of the negative as the negative. And we see it as what it is. This is what pure freedom is, the power of negation. It's not all that it is, but it's necessarily at least that. And in its pure form, absolute freedom as terra is just the work of the negative. So this is the thought of our freedom as the power of the negative, as death as the absolute master. So the guillotine is a kind of image of the purity of death as the absolute master. And it's not an accident that he thinks of the guillotine as this perfect killing instrument. Right? It's wholly indifferent to its object. It just uses gravity and the fineness of a point to separate life from death. So, at least on my reading, it's this stunning coldness that is the pivot of Hegel's thought in thinking about the terra, and therefore of thinking about what comes after it. Well, what does it mean to respond to the absolute loss of meaning? The denial of meaning, pure death. Right? Because, again, it's not an individual who dies on the guillotine, it's, to use Adorno's phrase, a specimen. People are already de-individuated. Yeah?
I have just a short question.
Yeah, what you can ask a long one.
What do you think about the difference between the terror of French Revolution and the terror of Nazi Germany? Are they just a
I consider, I mean, if this analysis is right, then Hegel is projecting the idea that death can occur via administrative reason. That's what I'm trying to get to the coldness. So I am trying to suggest that the organization of the camps as an organization of a perfectly organized bureaucracy, which does in actuality what the guillotine only did, let's call it hypothetically, that is, the idea of the camps was literally to reduce individuals to specimens.
right? You take away their hair. A head start. So do I. You take away their name. You take away their clothes. You take away their freedom of movement, blah, blah, blah. And pretty soon you have, right, nothing but specimens, not individuals at all. So they have died even before they move into the gas chambers themselves. So I am certainly claiming, I mean to be claiming, that I see in the book analysis exactly that kind of anticipation. Of not just, of course, I mean, of course, I think it does end, his way of doing the Terra, which, by the way, people have read against him, right? I'll say a bit about that in a moment, right? Something's wrong with Hegel on the Terra because it's like Auschwitz and we can't learn anything from Auschwitz, right? That's the argument. I'll come back to that. But my way of reading is certainly to say that he understands something about modern reason and therefore the history of revolution since the French Revolution, the history of total war since the French Revolution. I mean, all of these are already there, I'm claiming, in Hegel's account. That this is just how he sees the problem of freedom, ideality, and reason hooking up. And he thinks they hooked up in a uniquely, and I want to argue that there's something about this, in a uniquely paradigmatic form in the French Revolution. After all, the French Revolution, unlike the Nazi genocide, you know, the Nazi genocide had to use a wholly illusory anti-universality, right? Anti-Semitism. Right? So there's a kind of beauty to the French Revolution and to the total wars, namely, we're doing this out of humanity. Because we want democracy. Okay, well, what does it mean to respond to the absolute loss of meaning, the denial of meaning, pure death? How can we respond to that? That's where we are. If death is the absolute loss of meaning, then how can Hegel derive meaning from it? This is the old Derrida worry again. But now it really matters. Master-slave, who knows what we are arguing about there? Well, because we don't know what we're arguing about. But now we know what we're arguing about, right? Now it's the French Revolution itself, an actual empirical event. And Hegel's setting the stakes high because he's claiming that this loss of meaning really did occur there. And if you are of a certain temperament, right, like Burke, use a powerful example, you will say that shows what's wrong with liberalism, idealism, freedom, and democracy. Right? So Burke just said there's only one response to the revolution: turn around and go the other way. Walk backward. Hegel does not think we can walk backward. Hegel does want it both ways. That is, does want to say there's an absolute absence or loss of meaning, and that from that meaning must emerge. Well, the first thing, I have a bunch of things to say here, so let me just kind of see if I can do this in an intuitive way. Because it's a knot in the text, in Hegel's way through it is just too quick in the text. It doesn't tell us a lot of what's going on or what the stakes are. The Terra enters the phenomenology for Hegel
as but one more example of the fruitless effort of mastering objectivity by killing it. It is not a unique event, but a pattern, because as we've seen before, each act of grasping, of trying to reduce the object to oneself, is a way of killing the object. That's there, that's been there, even in sense certainty. We kill the object delicately, and skepticism more violently. I mean, we've been killing objects a lot. It's what we do best. But we carry on. So let's say that the French Revolution, just intuitively, just to remind ourselves, had survivors. Not everyone died. And everyone who went through the hopes of the revolution experienced the terror. And surviving it had something to do with that fact. So therefore, what we have to do is make sense of those deaths as something that we have directly or indirectly witnessed. And in the witnessing of it, what we witness is precisely the absolute loss of meaning. What we witness is the impossibility of, or what we learn, or the first thought we have is, the notion of absolute meaning is absolute death. That's all absoluteness can be. That's what I meant by the desire for absolute presence. Think of that as a desire for fulfilled or complete or saturated meaning. Right? So I'm saying that desire, inactive, is deathly. So the second thought that occurs from that is there is nothing absolute that we can will. Because to will the absolute is to will death. But if to will the absolute is to will death, then we are at a certain level groundless. That is, we do not have an absolute or unconditional ground. That is, we are forever debarred from metaphysical completeness, or to say the same in a different way, ultimately meaninglessness denotes our finitude, and that the acknowledgement of our finitude is constitutive. The acknowledgement of our finitude is going to be constitutive of whatever, I'm just going to have to use scare quotes now, infinite life we may have. So Hegel here does exactly what he did in the master-slave dialectic and says, just like the master wanting complete affirmation forgets something, and what the master forgets is life is necessary for self-consciousness. So too, life is necessary for freedom. That is, the only kind of free beings are living beings, not purely free, but literally living beings whose freedom is a property of them being alive and inhabiting a world. So in paragraph 594, you'll see that he presents the recovery out of the French Revolution initially as not unlike the slaves' recognition of the memento mori represented by the absolute master death. So he says, out of this tumult, spirit would be thrown back to its starting point, to the ethical and real world of culture. And now, I just don't know if he's being ironic or not here, which would have been merely refreshed and rejuvenated by the fear of the Lord and Master, which has again entered men's hearts. So now he's taking the Terra as, like the master and master slave, as another, but now a cultural, memento mori. That it enters into the cultural sphere as a reminder of our finitude. So he says spirit would have to traverse anew and continually repeat this cycle of necessity if the result were only the complete interpenetration of self-consciousness and substance, an interpenetration in which self-consciousness, which has experienced the negative power of its universal essence acting on it, would desire to know itself and find itself, not as this particular individual, but only as universal, and therefore too would be able to endure the objective reality of universal spirit, a reality excluding self-consciousness qua particular. That is, if I'm reading that sentence, which is very long, all right, I'm suggesting that he says, this will happen again and again, every time you seek the universal. That is, this is the thesis of total war. And he's saying, it's going to keep doing this, right? Unless it changes its point of orientation. But in absolute freedom, there was no reciprocal action between a consciousness that is immersed in the complexity of existence or that sets itself specific aims and thoughts and a valid external world, whether of reality or thought. Instead, the world was absolutely in the form of consciousness as universal will, and equally self-consciousness was drawn together out of the whole expanse of existence or in manifested aims and judgments and concentrated into a simple self. The complaint then is that absolute freedom imagines that we are completely or freely self-grounded. Which is to say that it forgets that there has been a world and a history. And that world and history have conditioned its very possibility. So it is another example of forgetting its own conditions of possibility. Which is to say, and this of course is the paradigm of everything that happens in the chapter on spirit, that spirit is always, as we progress to the Hegelian moment, a forgetfulness of its conditions of possibility, that is, social and historical existence. So we have to relearn historically that freedom must itself be historical, be mediated. That living freedom requires some kind of mediation. In the philosophy of right, Hegel will theorize that mediation in terms of a series of institutions. So the way the philosophy of right works is it simply begins with abstract freedom, right? And then it simply progresses into moral freedom, so mediated by universality. Well, it's going to go abstract freedom is going to entail some notion of the right to freedom, and right will require morality, and morality eventually is going to require a series of institutions, namely the family, civil society, and the state. So he's going to argue abstractly or formally in the philosophy of right from abstract freedom to the necessary requirement of living in a certain kind of state as a condition of possibility for this first moment. Right? So it is a movement from abstract to concrete in the philosophy of right, but equally a movement from an item into its grounds of possibility. So this type of presuppositional. The argument here is of a different kind, and it's of a different kind because, if you remember what we're doing here, we're trying to get to the moment where spirit comes to know itself as spirit. That is, we're trying to get to an account of not the mere mediations that make freedom possible, but for the mediations that allow us to recognize ourselves as historical beings generally. So here, as I've already suggested, Hegel is then going to just track back to the idea that life is necessary for self-consciousness and use the guillotine as the image of the absolute master. But in order to do that, we have to somehow we have to internalize absolute freedom. We have to internalize the idea of the guillotine and learn to mediate it. And Hegel's going to argue, and I'll come back to this in a moment, that this is just what German idealism sought to do. That German idealism is the continuation of the French Revolution in thought. Nonetheless, before I do that transition, it needs to be said, Hegel's wager is going to be that by this recurrent pattern of deaths, that these examples of attempting to ground oneself and that grounding turning into death dealing, which he calls, in the philosophy of history, the slaughter bench of history, that this is going to present itself at the end of the book as the Golgotha of spirit. And that therefore, and here's the thought, that somehow this melancholic repetition of death can be turned into a kind of mourning. So when you look at forgiveness, I want to claim you should be looking at a structure of mourning. That's what forgiveness is going to be. That's what forgiveness is. Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious as to why this argument about the French Revolution is absolutely terrible doesn't end up collapsing back into what we saw with respect to reason. So this forgetting becomes sort of the unconscious spirit. Right? And then you end up with the spirit becoming the bone, mimetic adaptation to death. But if that were the case, if the logic is similar to the one we found in reason, why do we find the French Revolution in spirit and not in reason?
It's because, so the way this is going to work, right, is even though Kant's moral philosophy predates the French Revolution, he's going to argue, by the way, exactly the way that Schlegel says it's the case, that when the Romantics looked back on Kant, this is what they saw. They actually saw the French Revolution in thought. So part of the simple answer to your question is that at a cultural moment, the French Revolution got inherited by German philosophy, right? As a sheer matter of a redescription of what Kant's philosophy must mean if it's to mean anything. And the reason why, now the complicated argument I already gave you, the Germans thought that what made this plausible is that the French Revolution had to cope with a double inheritance, namely the absolutist state and the Catholic Church, and that therefore some of the viciousness of the French Revolution is because they had not yet undergone the true spiritual revolution of modernity, namely inwardness. So that although Germany was politically backward, still a bunch of scattered principalities, it got interpreted, and is interpreted by Hegel as, in a certain sense, spiritually progressive with respect to France. So it is a matter of how at a certain moment, remember in spirit we're talking about culture, not postures of individuality, which is still what reason is about. So it matters to this whole story that Schlegel, for example, in Athenaeum, someone will remember which one it is, where he says, and this is the German ideology, he says the French Revolution, does anyone remember what the other two other items are in that happening fragment? That the French Revolution, Fichte's philosophy, and Goethe's Wilhelm Meister all are representations of the same modern tendency. So political revolution becomes moral revolution, becomes aesthetic ideology. That's the German ideology. The movement from the French Revolution
to the moralism of German philosophy, to the idea of aesthetic modernism. Call it, what's the name of Kristeva's book? The Poetics and Revolution.
The Revolution.
Right. It's as if, right? I mean, you can just put Kristeva here after Wilhelm Meister, right? Well, no, this is exactly the thought that Hegel's uttering. That Tel-Kel is nothing more than this kind of late revolutionary Maoism. But that was their view, that the only revolution must be the revolution in poetic thought. Right? That's the true continuation. Right? So what happens here is the French Revolution ends up as a theory of, let's call it beauty, which, by the way, is where the chapter started. Remember? I said the movement at the beginning of the chapter was from Kant's moral philosophy to the German view of the Greek world as a beautiful synthesis of universality and particularity. And that's, of course, where it's going to end up. It has to end up there, or the chapter doesn't make any sense. Right? So the whole chapter's been framed by this German ideology of aesthetic modernism. And that's why, bizarrely now, that's Hegel's real competitor. For him. That's the Romanticism, in all its forms, is the real competitor. And it's therefore not an accident that the ultimate character in the discussion of conscience and evil and forgiveness is going to be some guy called the beautiful soul. But the beautiful soul is just any number of different romantic figures. It's Novalis, and it's Hölderlin, and it's Schlegel. I mean, don't even try to pin it down to just one, because Hegel's thought isn't just one. It's a syndrome. Right? As an inheritor. So that's the rough and ready of the answer. He thinks that, so this whole chapter has been a circling around the fact that at a certain moment, the high point in our collective cultural self-understanding seemed to be the revolution in poetic thought, as it did in a certain moment in the early 70s, after another revolution had failed, or a series of revolutions, right? It just keeps happening again and again. So that's the end. That's the twist. Nonetheless, so let me see if I can keep. I'm still doing this introduction. This is dangerous. Introduction to a thought. I never get off of it. But I feel that something is owed here. So what I want to say, and I think it's neat, if this story I'm telling is right, then we need to concede something that seems counterintuitive. And the counterintuitive thought is something like this. Something about being a human being is like being a vampire. Namely, that we live off the death of others. That we build meaning on death. And that we cannot avoid building meaning on death if we are to live it all. Now, of course, there is an argument that there are deaths on which no meaning can be built. And the arguments against Hegel are that, say, the Terror or Auschwitz. But I think Derrida believes always that no meaning can be built on death. I just think he's wrong. I think that's what we build meaning on. Well, how can we think about that? Well, here's at least, and this is why I thought it was worth taking this detour.
here would be something like the thought. The argument would be that we build and can only build moral universals out of the ruins of the slaughter bench of history. And we do so when and only when we can narrate a traumatic event or a series of traumatic events. So let us say that history for Hegel is a transgenerational communication of trauma. That's what he means by history being a slaughter bench. And it's what he means when he says in the philosophy of history that no people can inherit its own limits. That is when he says that every people, you know, grow to a certain point, and they bloom, and they wilt, but they can't learn the lesson of their own defeat, that their failure, their death, their collapse, can only be inherited later. So what gets passed on to the future is always a trauma. And the claim that we are refusing, and you know, I believe that Hegel is claiming that we are refusing here, is to see that this process of transgenerational trauma, call it the French Revolution, call it the slave trade, call it the genocide, call it World War I, is only if we can come to narrate this in a particular way, namely as a particular kind of tragedy, can we make ourselves intelligible to ourselves. Why? Well, the thought is something like, in claiming that the French Revolution grew out of the Enlightenment rationalism, and that terror was intrinsic to the French Revolution, that, again, the epistemology of suspicion is truly belongs to Enlightenment rationalism, as does its moral coldness. That this is to claim that in the only morality, to claim all this is already to claim, to say all the things I've just said, is already to start providing a tragic narration. And it's already to start providing a tragic narration because I am claiming that there are no unequivocal or unconditional moral goods, that nothing has the purity of what one might have hoped for reason or morality or truth. That these phenomena are always and necessarily two-sided, not just contingently, right, but essentially. Essentially. So that Hegel thinks that moral universals will inevitably, so I am thinking again about that Benjaminian phrase which we talked about last night, right? That every event of civilization is also a token of barbarism. Well, we have to, for Hegel, think of that as two phases. And every event of barbarism points to civilization. That we can only gather ourselves out of the failures that are not accidental, but intrinsic to our project. That failure is not an accident, loss is not an accident, the slaughter bench of history is not simply a sorry contingency. If we had been more careful, all those people would not have died. So Hegel thinks, as does Freud, by the way, that moral universals emerge from traumatic events. Not just any old events, but specifically traumatic events, which is to say that they can emerge only retrospectively, that we don't have pure insight into the good. And that therefore there is, again, another way of saying that there is no thinking of freedom beyond history and the meaning of history that emerges out of the losses that are intrinsic to history. So it involves recognizing the necessity of recognizing an event as one of traumatic loss. Hegel thinks, and in this, by the way, there's recent some interesting sociological writing now by a whole bunch of sociologists around Jeffrey Alexander. You can find the relevant articles in his book, The Meaning of Social Life. In particular, there are two essays there, an essay on the Holocaust, from atrocity to tragic drama, and another one on trauma and collective identity. Right. I'm thinking about, of course, the Freud of Moses and monotheism. Right? That solidarity is gotten by killing the father. That's where morality begins from Freud. So, and that means at the collective level, and I don't know what I think about the individual level, at the collective level, the notion of trauma is a non-natural idea. That traumas are ways of processing events, and they're not immediate effects of events. That we only discover the trauma of an event after the fact. Let's say that for now, I would argue it's only in the 20th century that American chattel slavery has become a traumatic event for the American people. That it was not traumatic in the 18th and 19th centuries. Remember, I'm talking about collective imaginaries, not individuals. I'm not denying that. I don't know how individual traumas work, and no one knows yet. But certainly collectively, I'm saying it's a non-natural kind, the notion of collective trauma. So to call something a trauma is actually to elevate it as something that has to be worked through in order to go forward. Otherwise, it's just a series of atrocities. So it's marking out an event as formative for our collective identity. So in calling the French Revolution a collective trauma, Hegel was, just 10 years after the event, doing what I think everyone recognized, not only the French Revolution, but the terror as an ingredient in and necessary for its social reproduction, as what it would be to think that. So the hypothesis must be something like this, that if all moral universals are double-edged, saving and killing, if there are no pure moral goods, if freedom, reason, and civilization bear within them the potentiality of a death-dealing coldness and a barbarism, then narrative is necessary, and that narrative must explain, as it were, be that double movement. That is, showing how civilization turns into barbarism and how, and there's a necessity to that barbarism, not an accidentality, and out of that acknowledgement that our highest goods are also killing, can we again pull ourselves up and get something out of that? That is, to turn barbarism into civilization. That's, I would argue, the project of the phenomenology of spirit. It's been the project all along. He says so in the preface, but it's unintelligible when you read it. He does all well. Of course, he wrote the preface after he wrote the book, so he too discovered that's what he was writing about. Questions about that thought. So in this way, I mean, one character who comes close to Hegel here, oddly enough, is Nietzsche. That's roughly, he says something not this deep, but the genealogy of morals is a shallow version of the same thought. Namely, all good things come out of bad, nasty. Nietzsche doesn't like trauma. He doesn't like anything that's going to be too difficult. But nonetheless, what Nietzsche is thinking about in the genealogy of morals is best thought of as, if morality is historical, that's because it's essentially duplicitous and complex, and irreducibly so, and to reduce it is to have a pretense. Now, I should say that there are Hegelians, including my good friend Pippin, who every time I give him this argument is ready to pull out a gun. Morality isn't pure. Yeah.
There's just something that just puzzles me in general, maybe you can clear it up for me, and it has to do with the status of tragic narration in relationship to traumatic loss. And
right.
I understand the notion that the traumatic loss, if it's going to carry a tragic force for us, the tragic narrative, not just a sad one, has to be seen as having been necessary, having been formative for us, not just a contingent atrocity.
Right.
And I think that that's what makes this a collective problem.
Absolutely.
An individual one.
Right.
At the same time, and here's my puzzle, I don't know what a tragic narrative, I don't know of a tragic narrative that does not have as its end an individual death and an individual loss. So I'm trying to reconcile the one with the other. In other words, it's hard for me to conceive of a tragic narration, if that's what we're aiming for, that would be able to remain fully at the collective, structural, necessary level. If part of what gives tragedy its force, and in this poetic sense, if we're also after something like a revolution in poetic language, then it's got to be modern poetics as a stake at some level. Then we're given, even in the ancient modern, like individual downfalls, individuals to mourn. And I just think this is what trauma, for Freud, so the trauma's got to be about that, sort of structural father always.
So, I only have a bad answer, but I'll give the bad Hegelian answer. Bad Hegelian answer is the phenomenology is not quite a revolution in poetic thought. That it takes up the burden of that absence of representationality as a necessary condition for its thinking. So it's not an accident that he both wants to present a tragic narrative and a movement into reflection. So he is aware that the conditions for the possibility of philosophy are simultaneously the conditions for its insufficiency. By calling philosophy reflection as opposed to representation, he is saying it's not going to be able to have the motivational significance that we would wish of it. And in certain moods, Hegel, when he thinks about this, will say things like, oh, let's have a lot of good Lutheran religion around, because I'll never be able to communicate the philosophy. Okay? So if we want people to feel the death of God, feel the weight of reflexivity, I take it the death of God is traumatic enough. That will do. That he thinks that's the representational version of it. And he thinks that philosophy can't match that. Now, is he right? I don't know. It's part of what she takes up. Although, again, she is optimistic and a more microscopic. I mean, it's not an accident that from her Maoism in the Revolution of Poetic Thought, that she will say now that she believes in the revolution of the individual only, which is now her emphatic line. That revolutions at the collective level are now not even to be thought. That the weight of modernity makes that thought, and so on. So Hegel really does mean to be. After all, he's got to frame all of that. That's what he's doing. Except that and that the phenomenology is a way of trying to do that framing, to narrate that in a philosophical mode. But the mode has to be a movement into reflection. Because he thinks representation is always going to leave us unreflective. That's the shortcut. So that's the trade-off between philosophy and aesthetics. And it's why Adorno, for example, insisted on their irreconcilability. Right? He did not think that philosophy should even try to do what aesthetics does, right? But rather he thought of them as talking to one another in a certain way. And you can say that in thinking about them talking to one another in a certain way, he's simply repeating the Hegelian notion of absolute spirit. That it's not an accident that absolute spirit has three forms. Philosophy, religion, art. So I think it works like that. People looking at the board as if there's an answer there that's gonna sometimes just look hard enough at absolute freedom or spirit becoming religion, it's all gonna become clear. Probably not. Maybe that is a moment to have a short break. Because if there are questions about this, we ought to have a little think about them, and then we'll see if we can get to morality. So we'll be slowly. A detour necessary.